Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. This week, my guest is George Iber, and we are discussing his co-authored book, Latinos in U.S. Sport, published in 2011 by Human Kinetics. This past summer, in June 2011, the United States men's national soccer team played Mexico in the final match of the Gold Cup, the regional tournament held every 2 years for teams from North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. This year's championship was held at the Rose Bowl, one of the most historic stadiums in the United States, in Pasadena, California. Given the large Mexican-American population in Southern California, it was not surprising that the crowd was decidedly in support of Team Mexico. Shirts, scarves, and banners in the colors green, white, and red were far more prominent than those in red, white, and blue. The fact that a Mexican team played what amounted to a home game on U.S. soil generated a bit of controversy. One online commentator chided the Mexican supporters for disrespecting their American hosts. The controversy was fanned even more when the post-game award ceremony, in which the victorious Mexican team received the trophy, was conducted in Spanish, something which one U.S. player objected to in strong and expletive-laced terms. The Gold Cup illustrated the ambiguous place of Latinos in U.S. sports. Latinos are superstars in one of the country's most popular professional sports, Major League Baseball, and as a growing segment of the population throughout the United States, Latinos are a much-desired market for sports products. But Latino audiences are generally drawn to sports that are marginal to the average white fan, such as soccer and boxing, which creates something of a parallel sporting culture. And the Rose Bowl crowd's strong support for the Mexican team and the post-game ceremony held in Spanish touch on a concern evident in broader white society, a concern that taints current U.S. politics, that Latinos are a distinct and not really American part of the population. Although their book does not address this recent episode, George Iber and his co-authors do present the complex history of Latinos in modern American sports. Sports have been a means of exclusion and a supposed marker of racial differences throughout U.S. history. At the same time, Latino athletes in U.S. sports have challenged stereotypes and opened opportunities. If you have an interest in American sports history, your knowledge is really incomplete without an understanding of Latinos in this history. I realized this while reading George's book and visiting with him about it. So let's turn to the interview. George, welcome to New Books in Sports. Thank you for joining me on the program.
Thank you for having me, Bruce. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I want to start by asking you to give something of an introduction of yourself. And I know that you've done quite a bit of work on the history of Latinos in sport, in sports history. So could you just explain a bit about your interest in sports and what brought you to do research in sports history?
Well, Bruce, to be honest with you, it was a very, very fortuitous set of events that brought me to sports history. When I decided to pursue my doctorate at the University of Utah in the early 1990s, I was focused on doing something on Latinos, Hispanics, and the American West. And when I got to campus and I began meeting the various professors on campus, I ran into Larry Gerlach, who is a very well-known historian of sport. And I simply could not believe that you could actually focus specifically on the history of sport. And once I got there, I completed my dissertation on a very traditional Mexican-American topic. I actually did my first book is on the history of Hispanics, particularly Mormon Hispanics in the Salt Lake City area. But Larry and I would talk about sports history and about some of the things that were were happening in the particular field. And when I got here to Texas Tech, I ran into a gentleman by the name of Bobby Cavazos. Now, Bobby Cavazos is the younger brother of Laudo Cavazos, who was had been president of Texas Tech. And I began to sort of find out about his story. He was a second-team All-American for Texas Tech in the early 1950s. And I slowly but surely, I began to develop a sense that there is a possibility of writing about Mexican-Americans and Latinos in sport. And then after that, I just started visiting different parts of the state of Texas, primarily South Texas, primarily the Rio Grande Valley. And I began to unearth just some wonderful, wonderful stories on Cavazos, on the 1961 Donna Redskins, which are mentioned on several occasions in this book. And little by little, I began to amass this collection of stories. And as I would present papers in various at various conferences, I began to find out about Jose Alamillo, and I mean, of course, obviously the godfather of studying Spanish-speaking people and sport is Sam Regalado, and I actually had met Sam Regalado in the late 1990s, and we began to have this conversation about the potential for this particular field. And ultimately, Bruce, what it comes down to is that if you look at the history of various ethnic groups in the United States and their relationship to sport, there's quite a bit of work that's been mm-hmm. done on Jews in sports, mm-hmm. Native Americans in sports, African Americans in sports, of course. But we kept coming across this vast gap mm-hmm. in the literature that really no one had done. Sam had done a lot of work on baseball. No one had done research on Latinos participating in other sports. And frankly, the amount of work that had been done on Latinos in baseball really wasn't all that voluminous because, you know, Sam was basically the field. Mm-hmm. So that is what helped to bring about this group of authors that contributed to this new work.
So you have three co-writers with this book, and I'll ask you what brought the four of you together, and how did you divide up the labor?
Well, Sam Regalado came to Texas Tech in May of 2007. We were holding the NASH National Conference here at Tech. And Sam and I had been friends for about 15 years by that point in time. And we sat down with some of the editors from Human Kinetics who were visiting the conference and meeting with potential authors. And basically, the pitch that we made was, this is a population that is growing dramatically. We're now going to be the largest minority group in the United States. You have Latinos now moving into areas of the country where no one had previously expected them to go. This is a story of people who have utilized, in many ways, sports just the same way that African Americans have used it, Native Americans have used it, various ethnic groups have utilized sport as a way, in part, to challenge certain stereotypical assumptions. And that was the genesis of the current book. Now, Jose Alamillo had done some work previously on Mexican American laborers in various parts of California, but within his research, he had spent quite a bit of time talking about the role of sports and recreation in the lives of these laborers. So that's how I made the connection with Jose Alamillo, and also he came up with a with an article on along the same lines to a certain extent of what Richard Santillan did in 2000. He published an article on Mexican American baseball teams in Southern California. So that's what brought the three of us together. Now Arnoldo de León is probably the most important individual writing on the experience of Mexicans in the state of Texas. I had worked with him on a previous textbook, and I knew that he had substantial expertise on the 19th century, the 18th century, and we felt that we could sort of utilize the knowledge that the three individuals who had done work specifically on sport, plus Arnoldo's vast knowledge of these earlier centuries, and sort of work to put together these what turns out to be the first two chapters of the book. So what we did is we sat down and we decided which particular topics we were interested in writing about, and a lot of this comes directly from the research that we had done previously. Sam obviously made perfect sense for him to take the lead in writing about baseball. I had done quite a bit of research on Mexican Americans and other Latinos playing high school football here in Texas, a little less research, but still a significant amount on Latinos playing high school football in my home state of Florida. Jose had done quite a bit of work on basketball in Southern California. He had also done quite a bit of work on Pancho Gonzalez and just tennis in general. And so that's kind of how and why, and also soccer and boxing as well. So that's how we sort of came to divide things up. Now, the section where we deal with, for example, Latinos as consumers, my particular background, my undergraduate degree is in business. I had worked in retailing. I had worked in corporate America, for a few years before I got into academia. And that was just a natural area of interest, particularly because I grew up in Little Havana in Miami, and I would listen to the games of the Miami Dolphins when they would actually win, alongside my dad, who spoke no English. So we would listen to the Dolphins in Spanish. And it just sort of made a very important connection in my mind that, well, who were the advertisers that were advertising for the Miami Dolphins back then? Mm-hmm. What other teams have broadcast their games in Spanish? And I mean, again, once you sort of begin to ask those questions, it makes a lot of sense that you can begin to look at, for example, the Dallas Cowboys, the Oakland Raiders. And Sam had done some research and written an article in the late 90s on the development of Spanish language radio broadcasting the games of the Los Angeles Dodgers. So, I mean, that sort of brought that particular area, those sets of questions brought that particular area into a certain degree of focus. And, you know, I consulted some of my colleagues here on the Texas Tech campus in regards to, you know, who are the principal scholars that are writing about marketing to Latinos. And then after that, you begin to make other connections, and eventually you start looking at who are the folks that are writing about Latinos and sport and marketing. And I actually found a couple of master's theses that dealt directly with that topic.
So let's get into the book and the introduction of the book. You have a profile of Alex Tejada, who just finished last year his career as the place kicker for the University of Arkansas football team for the Razorbacks.
Right.
And so why did you choose him as a representative figure to start the book with?
Well, I think that the Tejada story it captured some of the crucial themes that we wanted to that we develop in the book. For example, Tejada is of Salvadorian background. His parents came to Los Angeles in the latter part of the 1980s, and eventually, because of the opportunities to work in, and I'm not saying that his parents worked specifically for Tyson Foods, but part of what draws the Latinos, predominantly Mexicans, Guatemalans, and Salvadorans to Northwest Arkansas, is the availability of work in chicken processing, primarily with Tyson. There are other opportunities with companies like J.B. Hunt, with companies like Walmart. And that begins to draw that population into that part of Arkansas. And what happens then is, of course, you know, the migratory patterns are very, very common. If you look at the history of Mexican Americans and other Latinos going into different parts of the United States, initially the first individuals that will come are going to be the solos, the single men in their 20s. Some of them have wives and children back in Mexico or back in California or back in Texas or wherever they've come from, and they go to this new place, Bentonville, Arkansas, and they begin to establish themselves at these particular processing plants. Eventually, you begin to get more and more families that arrive in these places, and their kids begin to attend the public schools in the area. And again, Tejada follows that particular storyline to a T. He comes in. He is limited English proficiency. He begins to learn English. He begins to acclimate himself in the social and academic setting of the schools in that particular part of Arkansas. He initially plays soccer, but someone somewhere along the line said, "Hey, you know, you've got a pretty good leg. Maybe you ought to try out for the football team." He winds up playing for the Springdale High School Bulldogs. He helps the team win a state title in his senior season. He establishes several Arkansas records as far as point after touchdown percentage, as far as field goal percentage, and just, you know, very much like your typical excellent high school athlete, begins to draw attention from a lot of different universities. LSU was recruiting him. Ole Miss was recruiting him. Nebraska was recruiting him. Vanderbilt was recruiting him. But he makes the decision to stay in Arkansas. And once he made that decision, what I found particularly interesting was the fact that at the ceremony at Springdale High, where he announces that he's going to be a Razorback, he actually holds that press conference in both English and Spanish. And he talks about how I want to represent my family, I want to represent my people, and I'm not going to forget where I'm from. So he sees himself as a role model to a certain extent for the rest of these young men and young women who are competing now for Springdale and for some of the other schools in that particular area in Arkansas. If I could just point out one other thing, Bruce, if you were to go to the Springdale High School website, and I did this recently, and by recently I mean maybe about 9 months ago, a year ago, if you were to look at the roster of their football team, it's easily 35-40% Spanish surname.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some of the research that I'm doing now for my next project, I've been in touch with some folks in southwestern Kansas, and I had one of the coaches with whom I spoke in a little town called Ulysses
mm-hmm.
send me a copy of the roster for the team that was starting the season for this fall, and his team was maybe 60% Spanish surname. So you're getting these Latino athletes in places where you don't necessarily expect them to be, and the fact that they are competing, that they are going out to do metaphorical battle against this town's greatest rival, and they're carrying the hopes and the dreams and the aspirations. The gridiron aspirations of that community gives a certain sense of what's happening in these little communities in the Midwest. And, you know, there's lots of literature out there that talks about how the Latino infusion into places like Springdale, into places like West Liberty, Iowa, Lexington, Nebraska, Ulysses, Kansas, Garden City, Kansas, is transforming and in many ways may be the saving grace
mm-hmm.
for a lot of these communities.
Mm-hmm. So we need to look at the history to move up to this point. And I do want to talk about sports in contemporary society and what you discussed and how sports is marketed and so forth. But we need to go back. Let's go back to the 19th century looking at the period after the United States has annexed the territory, the northern territories of Mexico, and mm-hmm. You have American settlers moving into these territories. And I was struck in reading this chapter of how the history of sports in the borderlands, the southwest United States, really parallels the history of sport in colonized lands in other parts of the world. And so for listeners of this podcast, the example would be Andrew Morris's History of Baseball in Taiwan, which
right.
we talked about a few podcasts back, a few episodes back. So like in these other lands, in the American Southwest, sports was both a way of marking the superiority of the ruling group and mm-hmm. as a means of educating and even assimilating the local population. So could you talk about this use of sports in the borderlands in the late 19th, early 20th centuries?
Well, the summary that you've presented is exactly what we see happening in the borderlands in the American Southwest. You have a population in Texas, in New Mexico, in Arizona, in California. They have their own sports.
Mm-hmm.
They have bullfighting. They have various sports relating to horsemanship and handling and working of cattle. And the Americans, as they begin to come in to those areas in the years after 1848, are making the argument this sport in particular, I mean, obviously right off the bat we're talking primarily about baseball, this sport is scientific, this sport is modern, this sport is what will teach you the things that you need to know in order to be able to succeed in this new capitalist system that is coming to the forefront in these areas. If you want to understand and if you want to participate and if you want to be part of this new society, this is the sport you have to play. And I mean, it echoes some of the things that Luis Perez writes about with Cuba. It echoes some of the things that Jerry Jems has written about in various parts of the world. So, for example, you have You have Mexican Americans, to use that particular term. By the time that we get to the 1880s, 1890s, playing baseball, you have individual teams that are comprised of exclusively of Spanish-speaking, Spanish-surnamed individuals. Some of those teams are quite good. They are able to compete against Anglos with whom they share this particular area. And the question, I think, becomes what impact does success on the field have as far as challenging some of these assumptions that Anglos have about Latinos. Arnoldo de Leon, in some of his earlier work, spends quite a bit of time, especially here in Texas, arguing, discussing the arguments that the Anglos who come into Texas with Austin and in the years afterwards, they argue that Latinos, that Mexican Americans are lazy, that they're not particularly smart, that they are violent, inherently violent, and they are certainly not fit to rule Texas. They're certainly not fit to have leadership positions in this new economy, in this new society, specifically because they don't have these traits that the Anglos have. But yet, here they are being successful in the sport of the Anglo and challenging them directly and in some cases defeating them in these particular sports that they bring in. And I mean, that I think even is becomes even more evident once football comes into Texas in the latter part of the 1890s. Now you're going to have teams from South Texas that are exhibiting certain skills. They are good. They will win at certain levels. Now, I've got to be honest with you, part of what I found out in researching the article on the 1961 Donna Redskins, which are the only team from the Valley ever to win a state title in football in Texas, is that you can have very good teams from the Valley or from San Antonio or from El Paso that are predominantly Latino. But what has tended to happen is they get to a certain point, they get to a certain level, and then when they're confronted with teams from larger metropolitan areas, the size, the speed, the depth of those teams eventually tends to overwhelm these schools from the Valley. Now, that doesn't mean that these kids don't play good football and that some of them don't make it into to play for even in the old Southwest Conference. They're, you know, not an enormous number, but there's a decent number of Latinos who have played collegiately at the highest levels here in Texas and in other parts of the country. And again, I see these individuals as challenging those assumptions about the supposed limitations that these particular athletes and that this particular population have. Mm-hmm.
This is your particular area of research in terms of looking at Latinos in football and the high school level in Texas. And why is it, this is a point that's made in the book, is that you don't see as prominent a presence of Latinos in football as baseball. And we'll talk about baseball later on. And so why is that? Why have you not had as many Latinos in American football as in other sports?
Well, I think the argument is a relatively simple one in the sense that only recently have you been able to have Latino families who have been able to on a consistent basis, give these types of opportunities to their sons, in this mm-hmm. case, to play this particular sport. Football is a game that takes a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of training, and a lot of families until very, very recently really just simply could not afford to lose the income-generating capacity mm-hmm. of one or two sons. And that is part of what kept a lot of these kids out of sport. Now, you have examples like Coach E.C. Lerma, whom I write quite a bit about in the book, who are able to overcome these limitations that are placed upon them because of the unique circumstances in their families. But you really have had, it's been a struggle financially for these individuals to be able to say to their sons, it's okay for you not to work to help support the family. Mm-hmm. You can go and play football. And again, if you look at the chapter where I talk about the Donna Redskins, there are several players on that team whose families actually would have left Donna and would have gone to various parts of the country. There was one individual whose family would go to Alabama and Michigan to work in agriculture, and it was a hindrance to the family to let this one son stay in the valley in order to be able to be ready to play to practice for the upcoming season. So that's the economics has certainly been an issue. I think you're not seeing that quite as much with the Latinos who are more well established in the sense that they've been in this country for a longer period of time. Now, in looking at some of the very preliminary research that I've been doing in a place like Kansas or in a place like Arkansas, I think what you're seeing there is these jobs in the meat processing or in the chicken processing industries are certainly quite difficult. They don't pay particularly well, but they are good enough that the door is opening for young men like Tejada mm-hmm. or some of these other individuals. So the economics, I think, have changed even for the newer immigrants than, say, back in the 1930s when it was, you know, it was nearly impossible. E.C. Lerma was the first individual to play, Mexican-American, to play high school football at Kingsville, and you know, frankly, he did it because he was the 12th child in the family. Both his parents were dead, and his 11 brothers and sisters managed to cobble together various jobs, various small businesses, in order to make it possible for him to make it through high school and eventually college. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned baseball as the principal sport that was brought into the Southwest, and the book takes note of various players of Latino background who played in the major leagues in the U.S. in the first half of the 20th century, and you even note that the St. Louis Cardinals had a Cuban manager in the late 1930s, Miguel Gonzalez. So professional baseball in the early 20th century was, would we say, theoretically or in fact open to Latino players?
Well, it was open to Latino players as long as they were of a certain hue.
Okay.
Because if you look at, for example, the story of an individual like Al Lopez, who is from Ybor City, his parents spent some time in Cuba, but his parents were Spanish, and he considered himself a Spaniard. But if, for example, you look at individuals like Armando Marsans or Rafael Almeida or a little bit later on, Adolfo Luque, when Almeida and Marsans were initially signed by the Cincinnati Reds, the Reds made it a point to indicate in their announcements that these individuals were not black, that they were Cuban, that they were Castilian. I believe, if I remember correctly, one of the articles that Sam cites talks about how these individuals were two of the whitest bars of Castilian soap that had washed upon these shores, or something along those lines. So, I mean, they're making it very, very clear that the reason these guys are here is because they are Cubans and because they are considered white. And the same thing, if you look at the life story of Al Lopez, Al Lopez, when he was playing in the minor leagues, he spent quite a bit of time playing in Florida, and he would go to play in various small communities in northern Florida. They would refer to him in very derogatory terminology, and they would call him a Cuban who was of black background, and they would use the offensive terminology, and you know what I'm referring to here. And Al would say, well, you know, first of all, I'm not even Cuban, so basically these individuals are not bothering me. And he, you know, he said, I know who my ancestors were. They were European. They were Spaniards. So, you know, he pretty much just, you know, didn't take any kind of offense, because he just figured that the person that's saying this doesn't know who I am, doesn't know my background. So now, of course, I'm sure that in his heart it had to have bothered him, because Ybor City is this mixture of Cuban, Spanish, Italian, and African American. So I'm sure that this had to bother him to an extent. I just don't think it, you know, he showed any kind of concern about the commentary that these particular individuals made about him.
So following from that, something that you do discuss in the book is that Jackie Robinson's entrance into the major leagues was a significant event for Latino players, just as it was for African American players.
Absolutely. Felipe Alou and the Alou brothers, but in particular Felipe Alou, talks about how significant it was as a Dominican and as a mulatto to see an individual of a darker skin color playing in the major leagues, and how that gave him hope and a sense of possibility that he would be able to then pursue his dream of making it in the major leagues. I mean, if you look at a picture of Mike Gonzalez, if you look at a picture of Al Lopez, I mean, these individuals were light-skinned. Adolfo Luque, these individuals were light-skinned. But by the time that you get to the 1950s, and you have, and really the guy who we can say is the first black Latino in the majors is Mini Minoso, with the Whites. If I remember correctly, I think he played with the Indians first and then with the White Sox. But he really came to the forefront as while playing for the White Sox. Now it is possible for these Latinos of any color to be looked at as a potential major leaguer, and that is a tremendous step forward for people in Puerto Rico, Roberto Clemente, obviously, people in Cuba, people in the Dominican Republic, and in other parts of Latin America. So Jackie Robinson is of critical importance to African Americans and to the significance and the significance of breaking the color barrier in the major leagues. But he is also an individual that makes it possible for first a trickle and now the flood of Latinos who play at the major league level. And I mean, if you think about it, how many of today's major league superstars are of Latino background? I mean, Albert Pujols probably is the first mm-hmm. guy that comes to mind. And it is Jackie Robinson, and then later on Minnie Minoso and the Alou brothers, who make it and Clemente, who make it possible for an Albert Pujols to come on the scene and to take the very interesting route. And see, I mean, Pujols is also is an interesting character in that, you know, here is an individual that sort of ties in with a lot of these themes that we're talking about, especially towards the end of the book. Here is a Dominican who first comes to New York, but then winds up in the Kansas City area. Mm-hmm. Basically does his high school and his very brief stint in community college in the Kansas City area, and it's perfectly normal. No one raises an eyebrow over, hey, who is this Dominican kid and where's he from? There will always be folks who will argue, well, you know, Pujols was hitting something like 460 something, if I remember correctly, in his senior year in high school, and there of course are going to be coaches who are going to bring up the Danny Almonte issue about, well, are we really sure that this kid is 18? And it mm-hmm, turns mm-hmm. out that he was. So there's not the sense that this kid doesn't belong on the field mm-hmm. because he's Dominican or because he's of a certain hue. The question that people, the one question that most of these guys have left to ask is, well, is he really 18 years old? Mm-hmm. So I mean, things have changed very, very dramatically, and you can trace most of this directly back to Jackie Robinson, obviously.
Mm-hmm. So the book features on the cover Roberto Clemente, whom you just mm-hmm. mentioned as well. And I'll ask, you had said before we started the interview that you weren't involved in choosing the picture, but you were very happy to have his picture on the cover of the book. So why was Clemente so important for the history of Latinos in U.S. sports?
Well, Clemente is an individual who is arguably the first superstar. Mm-hmm. You know, he will get his 3,000th hit. The way that he dies is also obviously adds to his to the luster of his career and of his life. But more than anything else, I think Clemente is a very proud individual who does not suffer fools gladly. Mm-hmm. And he is an individual that challenges the way that reporters in Pittsburgh and in other parts of the country portray him in the newspaper. He challenges them and says, you know, maybe if it weren't for the fact that I'm black and that I'm Puerto Rican, you guys wouldn't doubt me as much as you do when I say that my neck hurts or that I'm injured, or you wouldn't mm-hmm. say the things that you say about the way that I play baseball. Clemente was considered in the earlier part of his career, he was considered a hot dog. You know, mm-hmm. he supposedly was, well, it's not that he was a hot dog. This is how he learned to play the game. It's very similar to some of the arguments that are made about Jackie Robinson and later Willie Mays and some of the African Americans who spent some time in the Negro Leagues or who grew up in that milieu, and they learned to play the game in a different way. And that's part of what Clemente does. you know, he really is, he was my childhood idol. When I was a kid growing up in Miami, of course, we had no Major League Baseball in South Florida, and some folks would argue that we still don't, but he was my idol because my dad spoke very highly of him, and he was Latino. He played with just this reckless abandon, and he was just a fabulous ball player, and I came to admire him greatly. And I was about 11 when he passed, and it was one of the saddest days of my young life to that moment when we heard what happened to him. So the fact that the editors and the folks over at Human Kinetics selected him for the cover of the book, I was just ecstatic. So I thought the cover, you know, they said, well, maybe we've got a couple of other choices or a couple, and of course I consulted with my colleagues, but I said, you know what, this cover really does, I think, a wonderful job of conveying the pride and the notion of identity and the vigorous element of our community as far as participating in sports by both men and women. And I think all of that is encapsulated in that very wonderful photograph of Clemente on the on-deck circle in his pirate uniform.
So right now it's October, it's playoff time in baseball. And in my neighborhood up here in Michigan, the series that most people are following is the American League Champ. Well, in your neighborhood too, down in Texas.
Absolutely.
Between
Absolutely.
The Tigers and the Rangers. And so we have players in this series like Miguel Cabrera, Victor Martinez, Adrian Beltre, Nelson Cruz, Neftali Feliz. So Latino players are so prominent in Major League Baseball. Next year, Albert Pujols is going to be the richest player in the history.
Bar none.
Yeah,
bar none.
Of baseball. So looking at the prominence of Latino players today, you think this is a great time for Latino baseball players. But as a historian, are there issues that you look at in baseball today that give you pause, that cause concern for you?
Well, you know, it's not just the issue of what is happening back, for example, in the Dominican Republic. That's part of it. I don't think that Latinos have yet gotten to a point where succeeding in athletics is the be-all and end-all. I mean, you have the Albert Pujols, you have the Tony Romos, you have athletes in other sports, and I think that these men and a few women are definite role models. But at the same time, I think you have a sense that these are very unique individuals. So in that regard, you know, some of the things that unfortunately you see in some parts of the African American community where athletic is seen as the mechanism, I don't think we've quite reached that point yet with Latinos. Now, as far as baseball players are concerned, my biggest concern is the treatment, the way that these kids, primarily in the Dominican, are treated. I think things have improved, but you still have to take into consideration how are these young men being treated, what are their opportunities for an education. Is baseball the only path that these kids have, and unfortunately for a lot of them, it is. What responsibility does Major League Baseball have to give back and sort of look out for the interests? You know, Albert Pujols, people like that, I mean, they're going to make their money. I don't begrudge them that. But what about the individuals who never make it off of the academies? in the Dominican Republic, and now you're 17, 18, 19, 20 years old. You've invested basically your entire life into the possibility that, or the dream that you were going to make it into the big leagues and make a lot of money, and now what? I don't think that filter has filtered down so much into the other sports. I don't think you see, for example, these kids in Donna in the 1960s, these kids in Kansas today, I don't think necessarily that those kids are looking at, I'm going to make it into the NFL and I'm going to be famous. And I don't think that is the mindset. I think that there is, in a strange way, there's something positive about that, if you understand what I'm saying. Some of these kids will get opportunities to play maybe at the next level. I don't think a lot of them, and I mean that you're playing the percentages here, a lot of them are not going to be in playing Division I football for major powers like Tejada did. But there are lots of examples of some of the of these Latino kids being able to make it, and young women as well, being able to get scholarships to NAIA schools or smaller institutions where they can actually go get an education, play their sport, and go on and be successful in all of their pursuits in life. And frankly, I think that's the greatest value of this movement of these Latino kids into these communities and participating in the sports of these communities over the last 20-some 30 years.
So I want to ask a general question about athletic stereotypes. And when you were talking earlier about the introduction of American team sports into the borderlands in the Southwest, you mentioned these stereotypes held by American whites back then, that they considered themselves to be the superior athletes, whereas Mexican Americans were regarded as lazy, as undisciplined. They were generally seen as unfit for team sports. And one of the main arguments of the book is that Latino athletes have used sports to discredit stereotypes. And so I want to ask you, how is this stereotype in particular regarding, physical ability and athletic ability? How has that changed in the last century or even in the last half century?
In a very interesting way, and see, this was one of the things that really interested me as I was doing the research on Latinos in the NFL. It was just fascinating to see how many Latinos have played quarterback in the NFL. And I mean, if you look at some of the work that Roden has done in his book on 40 Million Dollar Slaves and Third and a Mile, particularly Third and a Mile to Go as far as African American quarterbacks, I find it very interesting that you have people like Joe Capp, Jim Plunkett, George Mira, Tony Romo today. Latinos have been able to play quarterback in the NFL for a substantial amount of time. So this argument about the quote limitations of their intellectual capabilities to play the most difficult, most demanding position on a football field has not really been questioned. So it's been this issue of, are these guys strong enough, big enough, fast enough? And, I got to share something with you here. There's a publication here in Texas called Campbell's Texas Football. It is basically the Bible of Texas football, and you know what I'm talking about, how significant that sport is here. One of the things that Campbell's Texas Football does every year is they will have a series of newspaper reporters from various parts of the state who will make the case as to why it is that the best high school football in Texas is played here. It's played in the Metroplex, in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Arlington area. It's played in Houston. It's played out here in West Texas. It's played, you know, you have a very lively and very articulate debate as to our region of the state plays the best football, and here's why. The only part of the state that really doesn't get any coverage in that particular debate is South Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go south of San Antonio, there's not a reporter from McAllen, or there's not a reporter from Laredo who is chiming in and saying, now, wait a minute, what about... Because the sense is... And look, there are a lot of kids who are very fine athletes in those parts, that part of the state, but there's not... Once a team from Laredo, or once a team from McAllen, or once a team from El Paso gets to a certain point, as I said earlier, once they get to a certain point in the state playoffs and they play larger schools from metropolitan areas, the difference in size and the difference in depth really does become very apparent.
Mm-hmm.
And that has helped to maintain a sense that these kids are not quite as good, so we really don't need to talk about them as much. So it's not so much, I think, that people are making the argument that, well, these kids can't do it. It's that they haven't done it, so why do we really need to waste our time talking about them?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue to a certain extent, maybe that's part of the reason why up until the work that Sam has done, Jose has done, and I've done, and a few other folks have done, that might be part of the reason why no one had really thought about Latinos as athletes before, in an academic sense, because the field of Chicano history, of Mexican-American history, was focused on labor and on community organizing and on issues along those lines, and sport was just not really... considered that important of a pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're finding out, the more research that we do, that sport was and is very much a part of daily life, and it's also a tool that is used to maintain and strengthen cultural identity, and it is also a way to break down stereotypes and to gain a measure of acceptance among the broader population.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about the scores.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, and I want to ask a last question, actually go back to Alex Tejada. And something you note in that introduction is when he started playing for the Arkansas Razorbacks, they began, the university or the radio network, began Spanish language broadcasts, correct?
Correct.
And so I want to ask you about that, looking at that episode. Not only looking at Latino athletes participating in sports, but how are sports now being marketed to this? You know, we hear all about it in terms of politics, this important and growing demographic group in the United States. So the political parties are directing their attention to Latinos. How are sports leagues and universities with their athletic programs targeting Latinos?
Well, you know, if there's one thing that teams in the National Football League, teams in Major League Baseball, and even in other sports have come to realize, is that Latinos love sport, that we're willing to pay to see sports, and that we're willing to pay to participate in sporting activities. And the NFL is reaching out to Latinos in places like Atlanta and Indianapolis and in Seattle. They're not necessarily broadcasting games in Spanish yet, but that might be a possibility somewhere down the line. You also, I think, need to look at the history of the Miami Dolphins, the Dallas Cowboys, the Oakland Raiders, and look to see what type of market research, what type of analysis did these teams do. As I told you before we started the interview, I remember very distinctly sitting down with my dad and listening to the Miami Dolphins in the early 1970s, and actually my dad you know, being from Cuba, he knew about football. Football, American football, was played in Cuba, but it was certainly not the major sport. But I literally, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, was teaching my dad the game of American football, and he still listens to the Miami Dolphins and the Florida Marlins and other teams in Spanish today. So there is a definitive market in an area like boxing. Latinos, especially in the lower weight classifications, Latinos are the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest quotes I think we came up with that we found in doing the research was a particular boxing promoter who was promoting a fight in, I think this was like maybe the early 1990s, and he talks about how, well, we did very well in California, we did very well in other parts of the West, and for pay-per-view sales, we did very well in parts of the West, and then we hit the Mississippi, and his exact words were, then we ran out of Mexicans.
Huh.
And all of a sudden the sales dropped off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Now this particular individual says, well, now we're getting lots of sales from Iowa, Kansas, Arkansas, not surprisingly, all these places where Latinos have moved into over the past 20 years or so, to work in meat packing and in chicken processing and so on and so forth. So you're actually seeing the economic impact of that demographic change that is taking place in various parts of the Midwest and other parts of the country. So the Latino consumer base is growing. They are being attracted to a lot of different sports. One of my favorite topics in this book was the section where I talk about the Laredo Bucks and the success that a hockey team has had in Laredo, and it's a hockey team owned by a Cuban American who used to play football at the University of Texas and played in the NFL, and now is a real estate developer and does this sort of as a side area of interest. And the success that the Laredo Bucks and teams in the Rio Grande Valley and in other predominantly Spanish areas of heavy Latino concentration in Texas, how well these minor league hockey teams have done. It's a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'll ask you to finish. I know that you need to head off to a meeting. What are you working on now?
Well, I am, now that we've done sort of a broad study that tries to capture as much of this story throughout the country as possible, I want to have a more micro study. And specifically, I've been working with some folks at Garden City High School in Garden City, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to see is the history of the Latino population as athletes in that particular part of the state of Kansas. Now, over the last 25, 30 years, there's been a dramatic increase in that population, but there was a Mexican-American population in that city at the turn of the 20th century. And there's a lot of interesting dynamics. You have Mexican-Americans who are, quote, old-timers in Garden City, and they don't necessarily find common cause with the recién llegados, with the newly arrived folks. Heck, some of those folks don't even speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting dynamic, and it's playing out in part in the soccer fields,
mm-hmm.
the basketball courts, and in the football fields of Garden City. So that's kind of the new project. It's at the very, very preliminary stage of development, but that's what I'm hoping to do, actually take some of the stuff that I discuss in this last chapter of this book,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of bring it down to a more micro level and see how some of the themes and some of the theories that we develop in this book hold up when looked at in a particular locale.
Well, I look forward to it because I learned a lot from this book, and I enjoyed reading it. So, George, thanks for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Bruce. You have a good day.
You've been listening to an interview with George Iber about his co-authored book, Latinos in U.S. Sport, published by Human Kinetics. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from history to public policy. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to New Books in Sports at the iTunes Store and link to our Facebook page, where you can offer comments and find links to thoughtful, shorter sports writing. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.